In part two of Taxonomy Basics, Ashley Whiffen of National Museum Scotland brings us into the entomology collection to learn the fundamentals of curation and preservation, including which pins to use, the importance of collection data, and much more. Ashley recently helped develop a new training resource that will give you a comprehensive overview of collections care. It can be found for free on the NMS website under our services. Taxonomy Basics is a three-part series on the basic components of species description, including collecting, preserving, and describing new species. This series focuses on entomological specimens, but it has concepts that work across disciplines. Listen in as Evan Waite, Ashley Whiffen, and Mark Milne share their guidelines and discuss important concepts in taxonomy, curation, and beyond.
Welcome to the New Species Podcast. I'm your host, Zoe Albion. On this podcast, we learn about recent discoveries of species that are new to science, but not necessarily new to nature. We ask scientists how they found these new species and why they matter. We learn about what makes a new species and hear some behind-the-scenes stories along the way. So join us as we explore the biodiversity of our planet and the scientists who help us better understand it.
Welcome to the New Species Podcast. I'm your host, Zoe Albion, and today I'm here with Ashley Whiffen, entomology curator at the National Museum Scotland in Edinburgh, UK. She's here today to talk to us about caring for entomology collections, including how to preserve, curate, and share them with others. Welcome, Ash. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on, Zoe.
Could you give us a little overview of who you are and how you came to care for collections?
Yeah, sure. So, where to start? I was really, really fortunate that during my master's degree in entomology that I was guest lectured by a few wonderful curators from the Natural History Museum in London. And they really, really enthused me with this passion for collections. And I didn't really know anything about collections before. Obviously, I loved going to museums when I was a kid, but I'd never been behind the scenes. So after my degree, I begged to go and volunteer at the NHM in London and had my eyes opened and became kind of addicted to this behind the scenes element of museums. Obviously, these jobs are few and far between. So then I found myself doing a lab technician job at the University of Edinburgh, working on burying beetles, which were a passion of mine at the time. Coming from a forensic science degree, I should have said. So I kind of got a background in all the death and decay side of entomology, which is great. I was in that job and then asked to go volunteer at the National Museum of Scotland. And one thing led to another. And 10 years later, I'm still here. So something went right. And it's been a blast. I've really, really enjoyed my time as a curator so far.
What would you say is your favorite thing about working with collections?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, you know yourself, Zoe, with a background in this too. There's just so many fascinating people that you get to meet working with collections. And that's probably my number one. I love the array of people that I meet, the researchers, the students, the other museum professionals, artists. Like, we try to make the collection as accessible as possible and welcome a variety of people in to use the collection in different ways as well. Not all, it's usually scientific research, but not always. Education is a big part of it, and inspiration as well. So I love that element. I also love taking the collection outside of the collection stores, outside of the main museum stores, to different audiences. So sometimes we do this through one-off events at the main museum. Sometimes this is through doing virtual events now, or exhibitions and displays. I love that. And then the other thing that I really love a challenge. So one of the difficult tasks sometimes is trying to conserve bits of the collection, maybe like a broken specimen or a collection that's come in a real sorry state. I love the task there of trying to repair it, trying to conserve it. I guess I like jigsaw puzzles, so I like that element too.
I think some people would say that's their least favorite. So I'm glad that there are all sorts of entomologists and museum professionals out there for all sorts of different tasks.
Absolutely.
I think that sort of brings me to my first big question for you, which is basically, what does it actually mean when we say to take care of a collection? So I'm talking to you in part because I received a few questions about creating a collection. And a lot of those questions will be addressed in the first part of the series, where we learn about what it takes to create a collection. But there's this whole other component, the caring for the collection, what happens after you've collected the physical specimens. So what does that look like? What types of care might a collection need?
It's a great question, Zoe. And I think it's a question that I get asked a lot, like, why do you need to care for a collection of preserved dead insects, right? Like, what is involved in that? And it's because of these, what we call agents of deterioration. So even though you might have some nicely preserved specimens, doesn't mean that they are completely safe and are going to last indefinitely. There's certain things that we need to protect them from so that they can continue to be beautifully preserved. So we have a few different things. I'd say like the four main ones are going to be pests. There are a few insects that as curators, entomology curators, we don't like. And that's going to be things like your domestic beetles or carpet beetles and clothes moths. And there's only a handful of species really, but they can cause an awful lot of damage and see our collections as kind of an all-you-can-eat buffet. So we do all that we can to try to protect the collection from these. We do that in several ways. We have really good quality storage that's going to help eliminate these insects from getting in the first place, really good quality drawers, cabinets. But we also then control the environment that these collections are stored in. We make the temperature and humidity such that it's not ideal for them to develop and complete their life cycles in a space like this. And then also we have quarantine. So anything that's new to the collection, returning to the collection, maybe from loan or on public display, all these things would go through the deep freeze and we apply low temperature treatment. For us, that's usually we have a freezer that goes down to minus 35 degrees Celsius. And we have those things sealed within polythene bags and put within the freezer for at least 3 days. And this would kill off any potential hitchhikers and protect the collection. So that's number one, pests. We then also want to avoid any physical damage to specimens. And this can happen in a number of ways, you know, through handling. Every time we handle a specimen, we risk damage. But of course, we could also have physical damage through, I don't know, like careless use of compactors or something, people smashing the compactors together. So we've got certain strict rules that we apply for moving collections around safely. And then we've got other things such as light damage, and that's why all the specimens are preserved and kept within cabinets, protected from light. UV damage is irreversible. You can see this in certain old specimens that have been like on display in galleries for many years. And then the other one that's really important is protecting the collection from moisture. We do this by, when we go through that freeze fumigation process, we wrap the boxes or drawers within polythene and we make sure that we bring them up to room temperature, acclimatize them so we don't get any condensation on them. And we're obviously keeping drinks and things away from the collection at all times to avoid any water damage. So those are the four main things that we try to do in order to protect the collection. And then caring for it as well involves certain other things, such as just keeping an eye out for any deterioration of specimens from other causes. So sometimes historical specimens would deteriorate even if we've protected them from these four other elements. And that might be based on the type of thing that they were pinned with or the glue that was used. So sometimes we have to keep an eye on these things as well. There's something wonderful in historic collections that happens with badly selected pins, which is no fault of the entomologists at the time. They didn't realize that this would happen, that any pins containing copper or copper alloys such as brass have actually deteriorated over time and caused this verdigris to be produced. Now, this verdigris is like a waxy green substance that can actually look really, really, really beautiful. And one of our colleagues actually refers to this as death blooms, which I have now stolen because I love this phrase. And it's totally accurate. So thank you, Tommy McElraith, for that one. These death blooms can be really beautiful, but they are damaging to the specimens. And you can actually see examples sometimes where this has grown through the body of the insect and broken the specimen in two. So we keep an eye out for things like this. This can be treated. And also, sometimes just pins can really corrode and cause further damage to specimens and labels.
I think there's this misconception that once you collect something and put it in a collection, that's a static collection. But in reality, it's a library, you know, the specimens get used, and also they have all sorts of adventures on their own that we might not enjoy or expect.
Absolutely, yeah.
And folks might know from their own experience or from listening to the podcast that collected specimens can kind of come in a few different forms.
Yeah, we've got a range of different types of preservation and then the whole different types of problems that they come with. So the most common that you encounter and that folks probably know of is the dry methods of preservation. So your number one is going to be pinning. And the dry pinned collections form about 50% of our collection at National Museum Scotland. So we've got about 1 million preserved specimens of this type. And so those are cared for in the way that I've kind of just described in terms of making sure they're protected from light, moisture. We can freeze this type of collection to avoid any pest attacks and manage it in that way. Other types of collection that you encounter in the dry store are going to be slide preparations and also papered specimens. Now, these are a tricky and very challenging area of the collection to manage, and we're all harboring collections like this. This was never really intended to be long-term storage, from what I understand. This was a fantastic method of preserving insects in the field and then packaging them up in a way that took up the least amount of space. And this was usually applied to Lepidoptera and Odonata, so your dragonflies, damselflies, and some of the other aquatic groups as well. And it's really where the specimen would be placed with its wings behind the body, flattened out as flat as possible, and then placed within envelopes. And these were often handmade triangular envelopes out of either newspaper cuttings or glassine paper. And sometimes the data is scribbled on the outside, but really these collections are totally inaccessible to researchers because unless you've gone through a digitization program with them, you don't know what's in there. And it's very difficult to access the specimens without causing damage. So this is a real challenging part of the collection. And it's something that we're hoping to digitize soon at NMS. And then, of course, we've got the wet collections, which is a totally different style of preservation. And when I say wet, we're talking about alcohol. So either things preserved in ethanol or other things such as industrial methylated spirit, IMS. We lean towards preserving in ethanol now for DNA purposes. Obviously, we want to try and preserve as much genetic material as possible. But this is generally applied to things that either don't preserve well in the dry form because they are maybe very, very fragile. And I'm thinking about things like the aquatic groups like stoneflies, caddisflies. The adults are incredibly fragile when they're pinned. So the preference is to keep them wet, but also any of the immature stages. So any larval forms, pupae, things like that generally tend to be preserved in alcohol so that you can maintain seeing those identification characters that otherwise would shrivel up and be obscured. So really important then that with wet collections, you try to keep those levels of spirit within your jars nicely topped up. But that is a real challenge because these liquids love to evaporate. So one thing that we try to do in most institutions, and especially NMS, is that we try to keep the surrounding atmosphere of the room nice and cool. So the temperature in the wet store is much cooler than in our dry store. We have sensors in the room that are continually monitoring the atmosphere in there, but it's also monitoring the alcohol vapor in the room as well, because you've got a huge quantity of very flammable liquid in one space. So actually, I can tell you that at NMS, we have a space, our wet collection, that is designed with the same standards, same specifications as a whiskey distillery. So that's how much alcohol we're playing with in this room. It's kind of wild. But yes, everything is done with health and safety in mind when you're talking about these flammable liquids. So it's a challenge to keep them topped up, but we're doing what we can to monitor those levels at all times and mitigate the rate of evaporation. And then another method that is more contemporary is looking at frozen collections. So many institutions now are also creating biorepositories where they're keeping material frozen for, again, genetic purposes and genetic research. So this is either going to be having big freezers that are keeping stuff at minus 80 degrees Celsius or 90 or so. That's another route to go, very far away from the real old school traditional routes of entomology, but is leading to lots of exciting opportunities within research.
When you were describing the papered specimens, my blood pressure was rising as you were describing them. And I think maybe not everyone has that instinct, which is probably a good thing in many ways for their own sanity. But can you just break down a little bit why putting them in newspaper or in glassine, folding them up, putting their wings behind, can you talk about why that's such a problem?
Yeah, it's So for a start, when you've got this little envelope, the paper that was used was not always what we would deem as being sort of collection standard nowadays. So it might not have even been acid-free paper, which like alarm bells ringing. It's always squirming right now, everyone. So yeah, there's that element. It could potentially cause damage to the specimen itself. You can see this often when you open one of these envelopes and there's lots of like discoloration and leaching from the specimen. And then, of course, they've been sealed and they've often been stacked into containers. And containers were probably whatever the entomologist had available at the time on their expedition. So these are often cigar boxes, biscuit tins, and the specimens are really kind of crammed into these. And then, of course, when they're pushed down, that's causing damage to the specimens. You often open up one of these envelopes and legs and heads are broken off. But the biggest problem really is that you can't see into these envelopes. So you have to physically manipulate them and open these envelopes. And every time you do that, you do risk damage. Furthermore, once you've opened them, obviously these specimens are dried out. And with the wings folded back like that, they're not going to be in an ideal position for identification, depending on the group. But particularly for Lepidoptera, I mean, Lepidopterists often want to see that dorsal side of the wing. So seeing the underside might not always be exactly what people need to see. And so, although it is possible, you can rehydrate these specimens, pin them, spread the wings, and then see what you need to see. That is an incredibly time-consuming process. And if you've got hundreds or thousands of specimens preserved in these envelopes, that's a huge amount of work. And we all know that museums are super under-resourced. So finding the funding to do this is just not really possible.
I think that I do want to say, in defense of a lot of these older practices, I think most of them were done with the best of intentions. And we just know so much more now than we did then. And frankly, it's possible that a lot of the best practices that we use today might have consequences that we're not even aware of. I mean, for so long, we had no idea that specimen DNA would be a valuable resource to preserve for the future. So it's very possible that we are engaging in some destructive practices now, even with our best intentions.
Yeah, absolutely. You're totally right. And you know, you live, you learn. And the only way that we're going to find out is by doing this. And our descendants letting us know and cursing us like we curse those that came before us. Yeah, you've touched on a really good one because one thing I often feel that entomologists of the past are turning in their grave over, or curators of the past specifically, is the fact that we do permit destructive sampling now. So yes, the fact that we can gain DNA from our specimens. I mean, our collection in particular was involved in a big national project on bumblebees in the last few years, looking at declines over the last century, and how that relates to land use change. And it was really exciting to have our collection involved, hundreds of bumblebee specimens used, and they used ancient DNA techniques to gain successfully the DNA from specimens that are up to 113 years old, I think. So that was amazing. And so,
Wow.
of course, we permit this now because we're just going to add more information, more knowledge about these specimens if we do this. But you think about what the curators of the past would have said. Absolutely not. You cannot remove a leg from that bumblebee. No, it needs to be perfectly symmetrical. So yeah, that change has to happen for the better.
Can you briefly explain why we take a leg?
Yeah, so a leg is often enough for DNA extraction. And we tend to take a leg because obviously insects have six of them. And for many groups, you're not needing the leg for identification. And if you do, then there's the leg on the other side, which is identical. So a leg is the smallest part of the insect that we can use in this destructive manner, that it's not going to sort of devalue the main specimen itself. We're still going to be able to identify it, and it's not going to cause any problems there.
Putting us in the museum, in the lab with you, sort of watching you work, what are some of the tools you're using? What kind of skills do you need to do your job? What does that look like?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about being in the museum and in the kind of lab environment is that no 2 days are the same. The material that I might be working on might be completely different. But most of the tools are the same. So our key tools of the trade, if you like, are our pinning forceps, which we use to pick up those tricky specimens from the drawers or boxes. again, this is something that divides curators and entomologists. Some of us do occasionally use our fingers. And I'm an advocate of this. I know I will get some flack for this, but I am sometimes much more comfortable using my fingers. I have much more manual dexterity if there is enough handling space on the pin. I think that's absolutely fine to do that. Where you should not be using your fingers in collections is when you have any pins that have no heads on them. So they're very sharp and could potentially pierce your skin. And of course, when it might risk any damage to the specimen. So if it's a very short pin, if it's in cork or a substrate that's going to give resistance when you try to remove it, absolutely use specimens for that. So yeah, one of the most important parts of our kit is pinning forceps to remove and handle specimens safely. We then have, I guess the names for these different tools will change depending on where you are, but what I call, or what I've been taught to call, watchmaker forceps. And these are the very fine forceps that you actually use for manipulating the individual specimens. And I will say that some of these tools are quite expensive. When you think about some of the tools that we're using, actually, they're medical grade instruments. So we're getting these from scientific suppliers and they are not cheap. But I will say that a pair of forceps I found in a bakery store that I use at home work just as well. And I believe that they're for doing like the flowers with the fondant icing on cakes and then like moving them around. And they're brilliant. I don't take these ones into work because I've got a nice fancy pair that I use at work. But at home, I have this pair that I bought from a bakery store, which worked just as well. And I think a lot of entomologists have developed their own kit over the years. And lots of tools, especially for dissection, my colleagues have created themselves, you know, with handles made out of long matchsticks and blades. And it's really about developing that kit that works for you. So some of these processes are very challenging, like dissecting out tiny, tiny genitalia from beetles that might be just a few millimeters in size. So you've really got to find something that you're comfortable with that works for you. It's going to need to have a long handle on it to use under the microscope as well. So yes, we've got forceps are an essential part of our kit, along with very, very fine pens with indelible ink. So it's really important that the kind of ink or pen that you're using is appropriate for long-term preservation. So we always, always make sure that we're using pens that have indelible ink or that you're using pencil. To be honest, most of the labels for specimens now are printed, not handwritten. And thank goodness, because one of the greatest challenges, aside from playing jigsaw puzzles with the broken specimens, is reading old handwriting and handwritten labels. And so he's nodding enthusiastically because, oh, isn't it a challenge?
It really is. I think in my experience, another challenge sort of on a similar vein is that sometimes people make a temporary label and they imagine that they will type up and print up a nice label in the future, and then it doesn't actually happen. So I really appreciate when people, even if they are making a temporary label, use the correct ink, like you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. I try to tell myself that all the time. And so even when I do a temporary label, it's got all that core information and it's written in the indelible ink, even if it's not my best handwriting. So yeah, we've got the forceps, we've got the very fine tipped pens with indelible ink. And then it's really just whatever tools that you need for working on the collections. Obviously, there's going to be a whole variety of pins. We have so many different kinds of pins. We've got the pins that we use for direct pinning, which go through the body of the specimen. If it's a large enough insect, if things are smaller, they might be micro pinned. And these pins are, you know, minuscule. I actually don't know the diameter for these pins, but they're the type that if you drop a container on the floor, they disappear. You never find every single pin that has fallen out of that tube ever again. But I will say to anyone out there just starting, have a magnet in your pencil case, in your toolkit, because that's really, really handy for picking up spilt pins that are very small. I learned that the hard way when I was pinning insects at home, and I still spilled a vial of these on my bed. Yeah, no, never do that. Never pin
that's terrible
in your bedroom.
A magnet is a really good trick.
Yeah. Yeah, because all these pins that we're using nowadays, I should say, are made of stainless steel. So that's really important. That's going to help with preservation in the long term if we want to avoid any corrosion of pins. And we're going to avoid that beautiful verdigris as well. Absolutely essential to use those stainless steel pins.
Absolutely.
And in terms of skills, having a steady hand is really going to help working with collections. I used to think I had a steady hand, but actually it could be steadier, I think, at times. I'm like, come on. But yeah, so, and really having the patience, because a lot of these tasks are very fiddly. They're really, requiring a lot of holding your breath and doing things very, very delicately. And then in that as well, I think if you're the type of person that is, if you're the type of person that enjoys being very neat and tidy and organized, then collections are for you as well, because it's just something about putting things in really neat rows that is very, very satisfying. I think everyone that works with collections gets that feeling of satisfaction once you've curated a drawer.
Absolutely. Yeah, so like we were discussing with the different preservation techniques, there are a lot of things that we used to do that we don't currently do, as far as tools and materials as well.
Yeah, there's been some changes over the years. Obviously, we've got the change in the types of pins that we're using. There's also a change in the types of glue. Again, this might vary depending on where you are in the world and what institution you're working with, but at least in the UK, we've moved away from the use of secateen, which is the fishy glue, as it has a nickname, because it is made from the bones of fish or sometimes other animal bones. And we have switched to using a PVA-based glue that's been more tested by the conservation sector. So we know that it's going to last better than those with animal products in. Also, adding more animal products into the collection is just going to add another thing that's edible for pests. It also tends to dry brown, which isn't great. And you can see that in older collections where you've got this brown staining on a card surrounding a beetle, which just doesn't look nice. And the important thing about any glues that we use nowadays is that they are reversible. So I should say that, you know, most of us can preserve, mount specimens across all orders, depending, like irrelevant of whichever order you work specifically on. So for me, my preference is beetles. I am a coleopterist. I collect and preserve a lot of beetle specimens. But in my training, I also have been taught how to preserve other groups as well. But when you return from the field and you're mass preserving and preparing a whole bunch of insects, you're preserving things that aren't necessarily in your kind of remit, and you might not be aware of how best to preserve like a particular genus based on their characters. So something I do a lot more of now than I used to in the past is card pointing. And this is where you have an insect glued to a small triangular shaped card. And this means you've got minimal contact then. And it's really simple to remove this specimen if the glue is reversible. And that's going to help the taxonomists further down the line if you've got some really interesting material and they actually decide they need to unmount the specimen and maybe do a dissection, pull out the genitalia, take some images, do something else. But there are some other methods that make this process a little bit more challenging. So in the past, a lot of coleopterists, particularly in the UK, will card mount their specimens. And this is where the entire underside is glued to a card. And again, fine if you're using a reversible glue, because the specimen can be floated off, the underside examined, but we are making a bit more work for ourselves. And I used to mount my beetles like this all the time. But if the easiest way to identify your beetle is from underside characters, why are we obscuring them? I don't know. So card pointing is a real great method to use for that reason. But similarly, like I might be preserving some bee specimens and pinning them in a way that is maybe not the preference of a hymenopterist. So it really helps to know the group and the best people to mount and preserve the specimens of those that are working on that particular group. So having a general awareness of the relevant methods for each of the groups, each of the orders, is really, really important. But knowing as well that we don't always do everything perfectly. And that's okay. I've gone off on a tangent. I'm fully aware. So in summary, the glues have changed, the pins have changed, and also the storage has changed. So nowadays, we're either using drawers or boxes that are lined with Plastizote, which is a polyethylene foam. This comes in a variety of colors and densities, but generally the standard is we use white. This is helpful because if there was any pest infestation, the signs that you're looking out for is like a fine dusting under the specimens. Looks a little bit like sand. This is actually the frass, the poo of the pest insect that's feasting on your collection. So having that white background is really helpful there. And in the past, the substrate that was in the bottom of the drawers or boxes that the specimens were pinned into was probably cork. And cork, we now know, is not a great thing to use. Over time, it shrinks. And what happens is it grips onto the pin. And that makes it really difficult for collection users to then remove it. And it risks even more damage. Or it the hole shrinks and pushes the pin out. And then we've got a specimen that's loose. It's rolling around in the drawer. It's potentially damaging its neighbors. So yeah, cork is really not a good substrate to be using in collections, though we've probably all still got many examples of this and we're still working really hard to phase it out. But with millions of specimens in collections and hundreds of drawers, it takes a long time and a lot of funding to upgrade all that storage. But we're getting there.
Absolutely. We've sort of covered the practical methods of preserving the physical specimen, but there's this entire other part of preservation, making sure that the specimens are actually accessible and useful. So we've gone through all this trouble of keeping them in good condition. Now we need to make sure that people can also appreciate and use those specimens. That process, curation, is something that you are very familiar with. Tell us what it is and why it's important.
It is the essential part of our work, isn't it? So I like to describe the collection a little bit like a library, but instead of taking books out of a library, you're coming and taking insect specimens out of the library. And it's a library of our insect biodiversity. So every museum that has a collection has an incredible library of insects, and we need to make sure that people can find the books that they need within our libraries. So it's about curating the specimens that you got from fieldwork or you got from a donor and putting them into the right place within the collection so that others that want to come and look at those specimens, access them for research or for other educational purposes, can come and find them and find all the specimens of that species that they need. Now, it's not always as straightforward as that. Finding space within the collections can be challenging at times, and reshuffling things and recurating things is always there, always needs to be done. But really at the core, what we do is we rely on our wonderful system of classification to organize the collection. So we don't need to invent a numbering system. We don't have to put things alphabetically. We have the system of classification whereby we are then grouping our insects based on the order. So all the beetles live together, all the bees, ants and wasps live together, all the dragonflies and damselflies live together. And there are rows and rows of metal cabinets filled with drawers. And so we organize then within the order by family, and then within the family by genus and then species. And so this wonderful system is already created for us. We don't have to invent anything new. And it means those that are already familiar with the groups that they're working on can quite easily find them. If you're not familiar, then you can use the checklists or our databases to work out exactly which drawer you want to go to find your specimens. And it's really as simple as that. But as I said, with the collection continually expanding and growing, sometimes space is challenging. Finding space to incorporate new material is quite tricky. I guess that's something else that's changed over time is that we now use unit trays to store specimens within the drawers. And these help separate out different species. And it also means that you can much more easily expand your collection because you're simply shuffling in new trays rather than having to move a batch of 50 to 100 specimens and shuffle them down to make room, because that's risking further damage every time you need to move those. So when it comes to recurating a drawer of specimens, I think sometimes it's just thought of as physically moving a bunch of specimens, adding in a new bunch of specimens. But sometimes, actually what's involved is a lot more than that. taxonomy is very fluid, constantly in flux. So we need to be checking for any name changes, adapting, changing labels, and also doing identification checks, because sometimes you come to recurate a drawer and nobody's looked at that and the layout of the drawer for maybe 50 to 100 years. So there could be all sorts of changes that have happened within there, species that have been split. What was once considered one may now be two or three. And so it's really important actually that you do re-identifications of material. That's proper curation, that's proper recuration as well. It's also a great opportunity if you have the resources to do some databasing at this point. It was a small part of the collection, maybe you could do that at the specimen level, and if not, at least a species index so that you know what species you've got represented, what taxa you're holding in the collection.
So even if people have personal collections that aren't necessarily being used by many people, it's still important and helpful to curate them. If someone was to look for a resource to guide them in that sort of curation process, do you have any recommendations?
Oh, well, I'm so glad you asked, because we have actually just developed a new resource. So pre-COVID, we would actually host in-person workshops as an introduction to caring for entomology collections. And these were strictly for our colleagues throughout Scotland. So other curators that were maybe at smaller institutions that were responsible for some entomological material but had no formal training. And so this was an opportunity for them to come for a day, have a series of lectures and hands-on practicals, and spend some time in the collection learning the real basics and the real essentials of caring for insect collections. When COVID hit, our institution moved pretty quickly to put some of these resources online. And so we began moving the entomology resources into this format. And it's only just now that we've managed to finalize this and release it into the big wide world. And now, of course, it's reaching an audience that is way bigger than just the Scottish sector, the Scottish museum sector, which is great. I had always hoped that it would be a resource for students and people new to entomology with private collections, not necessarily working in institutions. This is a real like beginner's guide. And so it covers everything, really, from the basics of why do we keep collecting insects, what the collections are used for, and then it takes us through the different types of storage methods that we've been touching on today, the different preservation methods, that's pinning, carding, point mounting, wet preservation, and then we also have a big section on data as well, data management, and hopefully it really covers all those essentials and all those beginners elements, and then we're signposting people to further resources on external websites as well, books, papers, lots of publications mentioned. I will say that the training also features videos, which were very painful for me to help produce. I do not enjoy that element, but it helps to make the training a little bit more digestible, a little bit more engaging. So needs must, and I was willing to do that for the greater good.
Your endurance is really appreciated.
Thank you.
There's this last piece of the puzzle. Along with these specimens comes their data. And to me, this is one of the most overwhelming pieces about collecting and collections. There's a tremendous value in the data. And when I say data, it can look like a lot of different things. It could include the date the specimen was collected. It could include where it was collected, who it was collected by, all of these different pieces of information. And that is as much a part of the collection as the specimens are. And in fact, oftentimes collections will either not take specimens without data, or they'll restrict the specimens they take without data, or they'll transfer them to a different part of the collection if they don't have sufficient data. If we are endeavoring to curate a collection responsibly, how do you ensure that that data is preserved for the future?
It is so, so, so important. A specimen has no scientific value without that data retained and kept with the specimen and then made accessible. So, as you say quite rightly, we don't accept specimens that don't have data. There are very few instances where we might take some specimens for display or for educational purposes, but we do not take them for the main collection, for the scientific collection, unless they have data beyond that, we're also making sure that the data is attached to the specimens themselves, and we don't want any codes or sort of shorthand on the specimens and then the data to be somewhere separate. And this was common practice in the past. Collectors might develop their own little numbering system, and they'll have that number on the pin specimen or in the vial with alcohol. We don't want to see that dissociation, that data being in a field notebook somewhere, because that's a huge amount of work to then repatriate that data. So we're always making sure that our donors are offering us material that is nicely labeled. And then if they're giving us that supplementary information in the form of a spreadsheet or database export, then that's fantastic. But all that core information, so the date, the locality, including Latin long or grid references for the UK, the collector's name, any information on habitat, all that core data is on the label itself with the specimen. And then, you know, the data entries in spreadsheets or data exports can contain a lot more information, which is great, but that core information has to be on the specimen itself. So for us, what we're trying to do now with our donors, particularly our regular donors that are maybe donating things to us annually, like rather than waiting until they've accrued a collection of 20,000 flies, they're bringing it in annually because they see the value in that, especially when they're getting exciting new records that they're publishing on. And they want to make sure that those specimens are deposited with us straight away, which is great. That's really good practice. And what we're getting them to do is actually database things for us. It's much more manageable that way. We're finding that a lot of our very active recorders are doing that themselves. They're maybe using platforms like iRecord in the UK or iNaturalist. So they're effectively databasing their records in the field. And then for those that they've preserved and kept vouchers of, they can very readily export that information and send us over a spreadsheet at the same time as they're bringing in their box of flies. So we're trying to move towards this now, particularly when it's a manageable number. It gets very different when you're dealing with very large donations, and we have not got a handle on how to deal with that yet. But we, in the last 5 years, introduced unique identifiers. So we now can pin onto the specimens little QR codes, little barcodes that are obviously machine readable, but they have a human readable code as well, which is really important. And this is going to give us that unique identifier in our database and help link that information from the spreadsheets as well that they have supplied us with. So that's a real step forward for us. We're in the process of cleaning a lot of our data so that it's then ready for GBIF and other portals, but it's really exciting to be able to be making progress in this way. When I joined the institution 10 years ago, that seemed so far off. And so although progress is slow, it's happening and it's exciting.
It's really exciting. So we know that there are lots of opportunities to collect collaboratively. You can go out with your friends, with a class, with a team. Are there ways to curate collaboratively?
Yeah, there are, in a few different formats. So, I mean, it's been long tradition at our institution and in many, many others to welcome a community of volunteers into the museum, to behind the scenes, to work on the collection. We're really fortunate at National Museum Scotland to have a wonderful team of volunteers. Many of them have worked with the collection much longer than I have. They come with their own expertise and skills within particular taxa, whether that's flies or beetles or moths. And they're just wonderful folks to have around. I honestly learn so much from them. I really, really enjoy having them around. But they also help co-curate. So they are using their identification skills to help us with unidentified material, which is feeding into that. That's a very vital step of the curation process. But some of them are also helping assist with the curation in terms of physically moving specimens from that old quality storage that I mentioned into the brand new trays, adding them into the relevant areas of the collection. So I definitely see that as a collaborative effort. Even if you're not able to get into a museum and volunteer in person, these days there's loads of opportunities online to get involved with digitization projects. Like iDigBio is always running some fascinating projects. There's Zooniverse as well. And these platforms are enabling collections to digitize their material and then outsource and crowdsource the transcription part, which is the bit that we all really struggle with because it is so time consuming. And often it really helps to have that second opinion, particularly when you're transcribing the really floral, like flouncy handwritten labels of the past. So there's definitely lots of opportunity to co-curate and yeah, curate collections in a collaborative way that involves a lot of different folks.
I have really enjoyed working with volunteers. And I also want to say that so many of the volunteers I've worked with have not necessarily come from a scientific background, but they have so many transferable skills. For example, I have worked with people who had experience in archives, and they were able to take one look at the handwriting I had been absolutely agonizing over and read it very comfortably. People come with all sorts of backgrounds, and they are really valuable volunteers and really appreciated. So if volunteering in a museum is something you're curious about, don't feel like you don't have the experience or the background to do it, because I think truly a lot of people can really contribute something very special.
Yeah, that's so perfectly put, Zoe. Time is so, so precious, and there's so few of us working with collections, staff and volunteers alike. We are so, so indebted and grateful to volunteers that give up their time to spend with these collections. And there's a lot of flexibility. We'll say that one of our volunteers is currently working on some transcription of field notebooks, and she loves it because, as well as coming into the museum and working with collections and doing some actual like moth trapping with us as well, she, when she can't sleep at night, will log on and do some transcription for us. And she loves it because it's this really satisfying task for her. And yeah, it's great that we can work together in this way.
Definitely. I will put some resources in the description of this episode on different places that people can volunteer virtually. I think there are quite a few and lots of different really fun options.
That's a great idea. Thank you.
Clearly, caring for collections, preserving them, curating them, attaching and managing all this information, it's a lot of work. Why do we bother? Why is it important to care for collections? And why does your work matter?
Why? I ask myself why at the end of a very long week when it feels like I haven't made that much progress. But these collections are so valuable. Like they're so much bigger than me, like in my lifetime. This is lifetimes and lifetimes of different people's work contributing to this incredible scientific resource. It's amazing to be a part of it, really. And so just that value that the collections have and the constant output that I see from the collections as well. So all these different researchers that are coming to visit, and then, you know, they're sending us the resulting publications, or we're even involved and we're doing that collaboratively. So just to see the diversity of research that can come out of these collections, and ours is actually quite a small one in the grand scheme of things. You know, there are much bigger institutions with enormous collections. And so it's just such an incredible resource. And really, we, particularly at the time and place that we are at in the world at the moment, with biodiversity loss and climate change being so pivotal, we need every resource that we can in understanding the world around us and the challenges that we are facing. We're still not fully tapping into these resources. That in part is going to be because of the funding challenges that we face, but really continuing to promote the potential that they have and ensuring that they endure for as long as possible is incredibly important work. And I, for one, am very proud to be involved in it.
I completely agree. And I and many, many others really appreciate the work that you're doing. Your guide is absolutely invaluable. A link to that will be in the description as well. And I'm so grateful to you for coming on the podcast and talking about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me on, Zoe. It's been great fun.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the New Species Podcast. This podcast was created by Brian Patrick and is edited and produced by Zoe Albion. If you would like to support us, please consider subscribing to our Patreon at patreon.com/newspeciespod. And if you'd like to get in touch with questions or feedback, please email us at newspeciespodcast@gmail.com.
Awesome. Is there anything you feel like we didn't cover?
I don't think so. It's been a bit of a whirlwind. And I definitely went down some rabbit holes. So sorry about that.
No, rabbit holes are encouraged.